Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 292. This week on the podcast, Puerto Rico is going to be an election issue in 2020. Maybe they'll finally get some assistance. And there's a new socialist in town. Also, a new unemployed millionaire. Plus, the SCOTUS rulings were released this week, so break out the Xanax. And if you're wondering why Facebook said it was the end of the world, it had to do with somebody other than Trump this time. Plus, there are two options for immigrant children in Trump's America. Be an orphan or go to prison. And it's okay, lefties, Bernie Sanders is going to be the president of Mexico instead. We'll have all this and more. This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, this is Lila without Brent this week, but I have brought in a very special guest to replace him. So please welcome my mother, Carla Nordstrom, and my father, Andy Barbara, will also be joining us as soon as he's done helping us with some of this tech stuff. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thank you.
I'm
happy to be here.
We're going to begin, as always, with Puerto Rico, because that's what we here at Brain Trust Live are obsessed with. We don't have any new numbers in terms of power in Puerto Rico, but what we do have is a story about housing subsidies there. There were about 18,000 people being given housing subsidies by FEMA in the aftermath of Maria. And there was a moment last week where it looked like all of those 18,000 people were going to lose those subsidies. And then at the last minute, a judge intervened. So it's looking like that, like those subsidies will stay intact. But both this and the previous issues that we've discussed extensively on this podcast led one couple of our senator from California into the fray, and she actually headed down to Puerto Rico, or is, I think, planning to head down to Puerto Rico this week, which is interesting because I think it says two things. One is that Puerto Rico is going to become an issue in the presidential campaign in 2020 because she is one of the contenders. And also, it's interesting just because she doesn't really represent that many Puerto Rican constituents. California does not have a large Puerto Rican community, but I think because it's an issue that embodies some of the larger issues with the Trump presidency, we're going to see a lot of Democratic senators and Democratic representatives start to seize on it, even if they don't necessarily have a personal stake in it. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with Kamala Harris. But what we're really here to talk about is the June 26th primaries, because New York State, my home state, the state that my parents live in, had its primaries. And there were some exciting results. One, I mean, you had a primary in your district.
Yeah, we did. And we had seven candidates running, and six of those candidates spent the last year preparing for this. And as it turned out, the guy with the money won the primary.
Isn't that always the way?
It always is the way.
But it's exciting that you had that many people even trying to run for office here, where Democrats almost never run for anything.
Exactly. But also, the voters became really educated on the issues and on how to reach out to people and knocking on doors. And so I think the process worked really well. We have, you know, we suddenly have candidates in this district who are really, you know, good candidates and know how to spend the time to learn how to do it. One of them was the winner, Antonio Delgado, but the others also came out of it ahead, and so did the voters. So we're going to see how it plays out, because Delgado was the candidate with all the money.
Right.
And because of all the money, he wasn't necessarily out in the communities. And so there's now a lot of grumbling about how people don't really know what his stand is on some issues and don't necessarily trust, you know, his positions. So,
but it sounds like just having an active primary was good in terms of creating a community of people who understand how to campaign. I volunteered at a high dollar fundraiser, you guys, last week, where I went to go see Obama speak, but Tom Perez was there as well. He's on my list because of his early endorsement in the New York State gubernatorial primary. And so I have already been ragging on him. We've done it on the podcast. You've heard us talk about it. But he did say, as someone asked, you know, one of those questions that rich people always ask about, what are we going to do about uniting the two sides of the party? And he said, we've been having active primaries and they are helping turn out voters. When you have a really exciting primary, people are more likely to vote. So even he seems to be admitting when it's convenient, at least.
Yeah.
That's the case. And that I'm sure is going to be the case in this district, because it means that people got campaigned to that have never been campaigned to before.
Right. And one of the things we've also learned is that very local elections, like town board elections that happen on the off years, once those start to happen, we increase the number of people who actually participate in elections. So that in our town, for about the last 5 years, we've been running town board elections. And so now, with every election, we have at least 200 additional voters than we would have had, you know, 5 years ago when we started this process.
Guys, so local politics is important.
It's very, very, it's very important.
But we had some exciting results in New York State beyond that. Obviously, this was not the result that we necessarily were lobbying for here in the 19th CD. But in the 14th CD, they had a huge upset where the number four Democrat in the House got unseated by a 28-year-old Bernie Sanders supporter who started running a couple years ago. The Justice Democrats had endorsed her pretty early. And so she was in the circle with a bunch of those lefty groups that have kind of jumped in to try to support some challengers from the left. But she unseated him by a double-digit margin with one-tenth of the money that he had. She literally raised $300,000 in that whole campaign, and he had raised $3 million. He was one of their big, you know, money, one of the Democrats that kind of they send out to raise money. So he was had been serving in that district since, as she said, she couldn't vote when he got first elected to office. But the upset really took the media by storm because and in part, I think, because she's so young, in part because he was sort of on track to potentially take over Nancy Pelosi's job, but also in part because she had actually gone viral a few months ago because she was in a story from like Now This or Attention or one of those that was about the fact that she lived in a community that was primarily people of color and they had never had a representative of color in that district. And so she started her campaign by essentially saying, you know, we deserve to have a representative who understands the specific issues that we face in this district. And she went and knocked on doors for what must have been years, you know, literally. And won huge and they had not had good polling on that. So they did not necessarily know that she was going to win that night. But no one even thought that that was like a real possibility.
But it's what's surprising about it is that it has definitely been in the wind. And people, you know, people who kind of pay attention to these things knew about her.
Right.
Knew, you know, what she was doing.
Well, she was well known nationally because she had gone viral for having this very compelling, you know, little media package that went out about her. But also, that wasn't the only New York City rep who almost lost their jobs that night, because there were two challengers in other districts that have very entrenched representatives that got very close to winning. Yvette Clark almost lost her job.
Right.
And also, Carolyn Maloney, who is reps the district I grew up in, that we also live in, she got pretty close, but from a challenger who had gotten nothing but bad press because he was advertising on dating apps.
Right. And apparently, I don't know if this was true, but the rumor in the neighborhood, that I heard from my neighbor, was that he, the last time he voted in Indiana.
Oh, I believe. Well, he just seemed like a douchey tech bro, but he was talking about the same progressive issues that Ocasio-Cortez was talking about in the 14th district, and that a lot of these lefty challengers have been talking about in local elections. And he got 42% of the vote.
Yeah.
For someone to get 42% of the vote against a heavily entrenched incumbent like Carolyn Maloney is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and I know because I'm involved with some of the people down there,
mm-hmm.
and they were sending out panic emails the day before the election, telling people to vote, make sure you vote, and all of that, to old line Democrats who always vote.
Right.
But they sounded a little panicky.
Well, they should have been. I mean, this was he made a real effort to reach out to younger voters, and that's what Ocasio-Cortez did.
Yeah.
That's what happened in all of these districts where people almost lost their seats. There was also one other exciting congressional primary result in the 24th CD, which is in Syracuse, which is a place no one ever talks about, with good reason.
Yeah.
but they had a candidate who stepped into that race right?
Dana Balter. Yeah.
And she was supported by the local Democrats there. But then
also the different groups that have formed, because a huge number of resist groups have formed in
New York State. Similar to what's happened here in the 19th CD, where they've there's been a lot of this effort has been driven by groups that formed over local issues like fracking and pipelines and stuff like that, and then kind of moved into electoral politics. But in any case, the National Democratic Party, I guess, decided she couldn't win.
Well, but it turns out Juanita Perez Williams, who jumped into the race, this is not the first time she's jumped into the race with money. Late in the game. She did it, I think, for mayor of Syracuse or another office in Syracuse. But she got the support of the National Democrats, and a lot of money was thrown into it. And she lost by double digits.
Yeah, it was kind of an embarrassing loss.
Yeah, it was very...
But it was an example of the National Democrats coming in late in the game to a race that was being... That had already sort of had local interests involved, and throwing a bunch of money at it. And then seeing that money go nowhere, I guess.
Right.
I felt like that this was one of the more impactful primary nights for the Democrats to sort of come to terms with what is going on in their own party. Because I don't think that Tom Perez would have been as sort of big an advocate of letting the primary process play out as he was the night that I saw him, which was only a week after this all happened, or a few days after this all happened. And I think it was because they were sort of like, oh, if we want to get voters, and they're voting by double-digit margins for these challengers who we're not supporting, like, what are we going to do, you know?
Yeah, but there was also what happened in Maryland with Ben Jealous.
Right. Yeah, Ben Jealous is running for governor of Maryland, you guys.
He was the former head of the NAACP. And actually, he did more for voting in Maryland than anyone has ever done.
Well, and Ben Jealous is somebody that I'm sure if you have been paying even remote attention to electoral politics in the last 2 years, you've heard his name. Yeah. You know, during the Trump election, he was all over the media, you know.
Right, because he was a Bernie
And he person. Was a Bernie guy. He was one of the main Bernie advocates or mouthpieces. So he's been kind of toying with a political future, if you will.
But he's young, he's dynamic, and they say, the pundits say, oh, but the governor of Maryland is very, the Republican governor of Maryland is very popular. There's no way he can be beaten. That doesn't ring true, because Ben Jealous, the one thing you know about Ben Jealous is he can do things.
Yeah.
And he's done them, you know.
Well, he's good at speeching.
He's a good speech maker. He's a very good speaker, but he also is somebody who, when he was the chair of the NAACP, they did more with voter registration throughout the country than they had ever done before.
Yeah, I think he's definitely somebody who has done the work to sort of understand how to reach out to voters because of that.
Yeah. And it's very clear he knows how to run things, too, because of...
Yeah, no, I think that's going to be an exciting race. And I think that is also a race where they were not expecting it to be exciting. So they are probably not prepared.
Right, yeah.
So the fun thing about New York State is that there's actually another night of primaries here.
Right.
New York State does not vote on all their primary candidates in one night. Because
why would you?
Why do that when you can spend extra money throwing an entire second camp, you know, election day? So the exciting state level races are not going to be decided till September. They're on September 13th.
Right.
If you're in New York State, remember to vote again, because you're going to have to keep voting.
Yeah, and also, just so you know, the dynamic has shifted because Alexandria
Ocasio-Cortez
was a Cynthia Nixon person, and so suddenly Cynthia Nixon is looking very good.
Well, and this is, you know, we talked on the podcast a few weeks ago about Tom Perez getting in trouble for, or getting in trouble with people in the party. I don't know if he didn't get in trouble with anyone, of course, but... for endorsing in the race, like, way early in the primary process. But the whole DNC is going to kind of have to be careful about what they say about this race moving forward, because Ocasio-Cortez is basically the biggest star in the Democratic Party of the moment. There is no bigger name in the Democratic Party. She literally has more Twitter followers now than any person in Congress except Paul Ryan. No one had heard of her, like, you know, a week ago. So that is going to be interesting because, you know, she obviously has been a Cynthia Nixon supporter. She's been sending emails to her list about Cynthia Nixon. She's been fundraising for Cynthia Nixon already. So, like, I feel like it not only adds, I mean, to us, Cynthia Nixon already had legitimacy, but she was being treated by a lot of people like she didn't have a legitimate reason for running because she's not already a politician and she's an actress, you know?
Yeah, I spent...
Locally here, she's been involved, and we talked about this on the podcast as well, but she's been involved in school politics in New York City for a long time and has been a pretty major advocate for the public schools. And so it's not as surprising, I don't think, to us that she would run. But I think this is going to lend just sort of like an interesting kind of legitimacy because suddenly being an upstart is going to be cool.
Yeah, but also another interesting thing is I carried petitions for her mm-hmm. in upstate New York, and the only people who would not sign the petitions were New Yorkers who were in the theater field because right. they thought it was just going to be the same thing like with Trump. And they were very, very dismissive of her. They didn't right. like her. And what we know in New York is if we can have a progressive, you know, candidate run against, especially Andrew Cuomo, because this is like the third time we've been through this, that he veers towards the left and he makes changes yeah. that he wouldn't make otherwise because he really is not, that's not his persuasion.
He can take a note, though.
But he does, yeah. So that's why we don't have fracking in this state, because of Zephyr Teachout in 2014. This time with Cynthia Nixon, two things happened, two big things. One was that we've been fighting for voter reform, and one of the issues was allowing people on probation to vote, right. and he just signed that as an executive order. But the other thing is there's this group of renegade Republicans called the Independent Democratic Conference right. that have been caucusing
the IDC.
With Republicans, the IDC.
We've talked about them before.
And the thing is they now suddenly have joined the Democrats.
Yeah.
And that's really because of the threat of having a progressive candidate running against him in the primary.
Yeah. No, I think that this yields nothing but good results either way because he has to know where the voters are. The voters aren't in yeah. the middle here. This is a heavily Democratic state. The
50% of enrolled voters in New York State are Democrats.
Yeah. And that means that less than 50% are Republicans because there are independent voters still.
22% yeah. are Republicans.
In California,
it's 40%.
We have more independents than Republicans.
Yeah, yeah.
But New York doesn't have open primaries, so that right. is one yeah. reason you would want a party enrollment in New York, yeah. whereas you don't necessarily yeah. need one in right. California. But in any case, the other big news that you might have been hearing this week was about Supreme Court decisions, because as you know, as we talk about every year, they, in June, dump all of their decisions. And this year, it wasn't great times for people. A few of the really major ones that we're going to talk about. One is in Janus, the decision that public sector employees can't be compelled to pay union dues or join a union. That's a big blow because a lot of public sector unions require union dues, which is how they make money to be a union, and then advocate on your behalf. And then public sector employees are one of the few remaining bastions of unionized workforces. And so to sort of lose something that allows unions to compel people to join is tough. However, we've been talking a lot about how this could be something that kind of allows unions to reform in a way that where they're kind of forced to make clear what their value is again. You know, unions had sort of developed a corporatized structure in a lot of cities, a lot of places. And so because of that, they were not necessarily making a good case for why they were valuable. But as we've seen with all of these teacher strikes in other states, you don't need a strong union to strike when there are real issues that need to be addressed. And also, wages are stagnant. Nobody has any job security. People are going to want unions. Like, I think this is potentially going to cause people to double down on their pro-unionness in a way that maybe wasn't intended by this decision. But I think the real group of people that are vulnerable here are actually people my age. I don't think that people who have been in unions for their whole career are necessarily going to abandon the union because I think a lot of them see what the value of being in a union is. Part of that is that the unions have done a terrible job of selling themselves to people my age. So I think maybe that's an area that they, if they want to stay relevant.
Yeah,
that they're going to have to focus on.
As a member of a public sector union, I'm not that disheartened by this decision, because they need a wake up call.
Yeah.
And this has been in the wind for the last 2 or 3 years, and they still haven't woken up to what they need to do. And so I think that it's going to maybe help them become unions again, as opposed to, you know, big corporations that own buildings and start schools.
And I think we're starting to see that people my age who haven't had access to strong unions have taken this sort of Occupy approach to unionizing, where they haven't had a strong union, but they found a way to strike without one. Mm-hmm. They found ways to advocate for themselves without them, and it would be more effective if they were able to do that through a union. There are a lot of states where the rights of people to form unions, the rights of union to reach out to people in different fields have been curtailed, and so that's why a lot of these like teachers didn't have strong unions. But that doesn't eliminate the need for unions. Just declaring that it's going to be harder for people to be compelled to join them doesn't really eliminate the need for collective bargaining. You need collective bargaining anyway. And so I feel like this is also just not a smart move for the right, who is now going to have to contend with all of the interesting ways that people are going to find to bargain or to collectivize. And some of those might be more radical than the unions that they were actually dealing with. And that's what I think I would be worried about if I were them. I see people my age being comfortable with slightly more radical forms of unionizing than maybe they're expecting.
Yeah.
And I think that that's their sort of short-sightedness that's maybe preventing them from seeing the full extent of what they could unleash here. But I'm hoping that they do unleash it. I'm hoping this unleashes that. They also upheld the travel ban, so that's just like them to do. Upheld that law. California had sued because there were these religiously affiliated pregnancy crisis centers that were not telling people that they had that they could have an abortion as well, that was an option. And so a case went to the Supreme Court about whether the state could compel these religiously affiliated crisis centers to alert people that abortion was one of their options. And they said that they didn't have to. So now you can open any sort of fake pregnancy crisis center in California and not talk about abortions. But you know, we're sort of heading into dangerous territory on the abortion front anyway, which we'll talk about in a second. So this is really the first of what could be a long year of these cases.
Right. Also, I think one of the things we always have to be mindful with Supreme Court decisions, the Supreme Court is ruling on laws that are on the books now.
Yeah.
So you can just go back and make another law.
Right. You can keep pushing them.
You can.
That's what they've
pushing.
Done with abortion cases, actually,
yeah.
Because that's what these fetal heartbeat laws are. I mean, the right has been relentless at passing laws that are going to be tried in court in an effort to sneak something through.
Right. Right. But the left can do that.
But
too.
The left can do that too. We should be doing that.
Yeah.
And then they also ruled on a voter rights case that's also very discouraging, where Ohio had been purging people from their voting rolls without the kind of rhyme or reason that you would hope would accompany such a purge. And the Supreme Court upheld their right to purge voters, which, here's the thing, also a very discouraging ruling, also a terrible precedent to set. It is still the voters of Ohio that can decide whether or not this is acceptable to them. We can, as with any, and you know, we're going to cheerlead a little bit coming up, because we're going to talk about the Kennedy, you know, retirement. But it is, every state can decide not to purge voter rolls, even if they have the right to. You don't have to decide that you live in a state that where you're helpless and, you know, to them purging your voter rolls, because you can decide that you're not going to live in a state where that's acceptable as a collective. I mean, you can personally decide that, doesn't do anything. But just because Ohio has the right to do this does not mean that they should be allowed to do this by their voters, you know,
right.
Or by anyone. But, you know, if the Supreme Court's going to allow it, it doesn't mean that it has to happen. It means that the Supreme Court is, you know, is allowing biased, you know, voter laws to, you know, to be legal. It doesn't mean that we have to pass those.
Well, and also I think part of what's happening with the Supreme Court right now is that they're losing their judicial approach to a more political approach.
Yeah.
And they are not looking very good. I mean, and it's been years. I mean, it's been since Bush v. Gore.
Right.
But these rulings are so political. And
yeah,
it's a very bad look.
I can't
for them.
Imagine a world in which, if by a strict constitutionalist reading, Ohio is allowed to take people off of the voter rolls who are legally allowed to vote.
But with the strict constitutional reading, the Supreme Court shouldn't be involved in
shouldn't
that
be involved
anyway
in this issue. No,
because
exactly.
It's a states' rights issue.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the sort of question of whether states are allowed to violate the Constitution. Because
yeah.
I think that violates your constitutional right to participate as it has been deemed that you are allowed to.
Right.
You know, and that's what this case was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be about whether the state of Ohio could violate people's right to vote. And the Supreme Court decided they could. Like I said, Ohio doesn't have to do it just because they decided they could. No state has to allow that just because they the Supreme Court decided they could. But I can't even understand how in a reading of the Constitution that is in English that you could have come to this conclusion in the first place. They also decided that it's cool if Texas wants to gerrymander according to racial lines. So that's awesome. They're just going to disenfranchise people of color in Texas as they've been planning to. But this is another thing that Texas voters should not allow this to happen. Texas is a state with a lot of people of color. So it's not like Texas should necessarily feel like this is, you know, I know that this current legislature in Texas is going to allow this to happen. I'm just saying, like, we should not decide that just because we're allowed to violate people's voting rights that we're going to, you know? Like, I think a lot of people view Supreme Court decisions as if they are kind of like, just because they rule something, it has to happen that way. And we don't have to allow this to happen that way. I mean, they can be asked to rule on it again. In any case, we also have a ruling on workplace arbitrations where employers can require employees to waive their right to participate in class action arbitration. And then the one positive decision was actually a decision where John Roberts joined the liberals instead of Kennedy. And it was about privacy laws. It was Carpenter versus the U.S. police, and it was about the police needing, versus the U.S., and it was about the police needing a search warrant to access phone records. And I feel like this is, you know, we've been talking a little bit about what his role is going to be in this new court, because we're going to talk in a second about what the new court situation is going to be. But I thought this was an interesting one, because it seems like maybe his sort of liberal line is that he cares about privacy issues. And I feel like there's going to be probably a lot of bizarre privacy cases that come up, you know, against the Trump administration. And so this could be an interesting thing for him to break with the conservatives on if this is something he does regularly.
Yeah, I think also another thing with Roberts, from what I've heard, he's looking at his legacy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want things that are totally destructive to our society to happen when he's in charge.
Right.
Because he...
This is going to be the laughingstock court of,
yes.
Of history.
Yeah.
And it so will have been his court.
Yeah. And so a lot of things that we're very afraid that this court is just going to go ahead and do, may not do because he, first of all, he may not let these things come to
right.
the court. He may not, you know, because he has some say in what goes
what cases
to the court.
They take. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also... There will be a, like he did also with the Obamacare case, he will join the liberals to.
Well, he is going to be the swing vote because
yeah,
he's going to be
scary.
The most middle vote. It's not what you're looking for.
Right.
And the reason we keep talking about this is because Anthony Kennedy is retiring, you guys. Our supposed swing vote savior, who, in reviewing his record, I've realized is about as liberal as, you know, as like Kushner, he was appointed by Reagan. There was no promise. He was not appointed to be a liberal justice. But in reviewing his records, there are certain cases. There are certain kinds of cases where he votes with liberals on. Those are cases that, you know, gay marriage cases. There were a few abortion cases that he voted with the liberals on. But he does not when it comes to voting rights. He
yeah.
does not. I mean, there are a lot of really meaningful kinds of cases that have come before the Supreme Court where he has voted with the conservatives to the detriment of all of society. And those are cases that are as meaningful progressive cause as progressive causes as gay rights.
But also this year, in the last, since Trump became president, he did not vote for any of those things.
No, he voted with the Trump administration every single time.
Right.
So, obviously, but also now there's a story in the New York Times about how potentially they've been lobbying him pretty heavily to retire. And there's some potentially shady connections between his son, who works at Deutsche Bank, and the Trump family, who received much money in loans from Deutsche Bank a few years ago. So, like, during the Great Recession, Justin Kennedy, his son, who he named Justin Kennedy.
And get the name.
Yeah, I mean, Justin. Yeah, exactly. He was the global real estate head of Deutsche Bank, and he loaned like $1 billion to the Trumps. And no one else was willing to loan the money, possibly because a huge recession was going on, and the Trumps are the worst at managing money. But, you know, whatever. I guess now that we know that he's been the focus of this heavy lobbying effort, I'm not entirely shocked that he retired. But watching the Dems struggle to figure out what to do about it has been sort of interesting. Because first they were trying to argue that because of the McConnell rule, which is a rule that they made up that was McConnell's fake argument that they, you know, that the American people should get to vote before we appoint a new Supreme Court justice, back when Obama had 9 months of his, you know, of his presidency robbed from him basically by them. But that wasn't really catching fire, their claim that we should wait until the election to vote on. They're still kind of talking about it, but I feel like that was such a shady thing for McConnell to do, for the Democrats to be demanding the same treatment is almost shameful for them, because then they're really sort of agreeing to subvert norms collectively, as opposed to just deciding this was an extraordinary and unacceptable act, which is what I think it should have been considered. But then they decided to argue, and I think this is a better one, that Trump shouldn't be able to appoint a justice because there's a potential that Russiagate goes before the Supreme Court, and he shouldn't get to appoint a justice to hear his own case. Now, I don't think that's necessarily as effective an argument, but I do think that it does a good job of reminding everyone that there's a giant conspiracy afoot, and that potentially that giant conspiracy is worth thinking about as we decide whether to let this man appoint yet another justice.
But also, I think there's another part of it that the Democrats, I heard Elizabeth Warren refer to this a while ago, about how if the Democrats, you know, if they win the Senate, that they won't do what, see, McConnell never let the justices, or the proposed justices appear before the Judiciary Committee, right, and then before the full Senate. And she said that the Democrats won't do that. They will make sure that everybody who's, you know, was put up gets a hearing. But what the Democrats can do to kind of slow down the process so that people can have, you know, have a good idea of what's going on is they can meet with all, you know, whoever he comes up with.
Yeah.
They can meet with him multiple times. Right.
They can meet with him for months.
Yeah, they can say, you know, okay, you know, come and meet with me. And then say, oh, wait a minute. I had, you know, 2 months, you know, a while later, I have a question. And I think that type of approach suits the Democrats much better, yeah, than doing what McConnell did. And that's their job. What McConnell did was not their job.
Yeah.
And you know, talking about legacies, that's one that should go down for the history books as a terrible legacy.
Yeah.
But I think that the Democrats should just kind of slow roll this thing.
Yeah. And I think that in slow rolling it, they should remind us all what is objectionable about the picks that are likely to come out of the Trump administration. You know, slow rolling it allows you to have real reasons for not supporting somebody.
Yeah.
Whereas if you kind of just don't allow a hearing, then you just look like a petty asshole,
basically. Which is what the Republicans look like.
Exactly.
With Merrick Garland.
Exactly. But the other, so the big issue that's been kind of like looming large over all of this is what happens to Roe v. Wade, because obviously this would give this would give Trump the opportunity to appoint somebody who will give the majority the ability to overturn Roe v. Wade. I have been arguing now on our entire car ride up to upstate New York, on many a plane and bus ride since before this, that it is in no Republicans' interest to get rid of Roe v. Wade. Now, that doesn't mean they won't do it. We don't know what they're going to do. But, you know, Susan Collins came out and said that she doesn't, you know, that she wouldn't support a pick for Supreme Court that is hostile to Roe v. Wade. Lindsey Graham even started to make noise, like he might be thinking maybe he shouldn't do that. I can't think of a worse idea for them than to decide that their greatest electoral issue is no longer relevant. I mean, what are they going to get people on? They don't have a healthcare plan. Their tax plan sucks. Everyone hates it. Their foreign policy is all scaremongering. People can see through it. The immigration thing is not going to ultimately be a winner because they've mishandled it so badly. So it's great if you live in a place where you, I guess, never have to interact with immigrants ever. But if you know, if you have even a small heart, then you know that separating kids from their families is unacceptable. So, like, they fucked up the immigration thing royally. But what else do they have? They don't have the gay marriage thing anymore. That's over. Like, what are the lifestyle issues that they're going to use as wedge issues if they don't have abortion? How are they going to get people to vote for them? I mean, it doesn't... I just don't think it's a... I mean, there are people that will do a smart... I mean, they'll look a smart idea in the face and turn their backs on it. I mean, so who knows? But I just don't see how this benefits any of them electorally. And this is also, like we've said, and again on this podcast, this is a dumb issue if you're not personally affected by it. It's not dumb if you're a woman. You know, it's very important if you're a woman because it has to do with your ability to have control over your own body and your own sort of, you know, freedom to live as a person. But if you are like some evangelical person in somewhere that doesn't believe in abortions, you don't have to have one. And it doesn't actually matter. Like gay marriage, this isn't an issue that matters. This isn't about, this isn't a government policy thing, really. This is a minor squabble over a lifestyle issue that has been turned into the holy grail of political issues to distract people from the fact that what they're really voting on is getting rid of social programs and, you know, taking away money from their kids' schools and lowering their taxes at the expense of having, like, any civility in society. I mean, this is what they're actually voting for. The abortion thing is a distraction. It doesn't matter to any of the people that it matters to, you know? Like, nobody who's against abortion has to worry about them because they just don't have to have them.
Yeah, and another part of it, I think it's very bizarre that they would bring up an issue that will affect the largest generation that's coming down the pike, who are the people who would be affected, totally affected by this.
I mean, this so would set loose a hailstorm of millennial craziness.
Yeah.
Because this is not a popular thing for millennials. Like, millennials are in favor of you having your right to have an abortion. That's not something that's controversial in millennial communities. So it would set off just like a firestorm of craziness that I don't think that they actually want to deal with.
But you also have the fact that the next largest generation comes from a time when it wasn't legal. And they understand what exactly this means.
Like,
and
if a bunch of Gen Xers want to argue otherwise with us, we'll tell them that they have almost no electoral power, so they can go screw themselves.
There is
also, because there's going to be enough of a collective memory amongst boomers that there is going to be immediately information about how terrible it was, and then there's also going to be a huge audience for that information. Which is, I think, different than it would have been in the 90s. I think in the 90s, there wouldn't have been as big an audience for the information because we were all kind of distracted by how fine everything was. I think right now, if people with stories about having scary experiences, having to get illegal abortions, would have an audience. I mean, everyone my age understands fully how dangerous, and also understands that you don't actually get to decide no one's going to have abortions anymore. You just get to decide they're not going to have safe abortions anymore. So, there's no one my age thinks that it's possible that they'll actually stop abortions in their tracks. They will just stop safe abortions. And I have one more thing to say about it, which is that because of these morning after pills, the context in which people are going to be having abortions is going to be very different. And it's largely going to be for health and mental health reasons that people are choosing to have them. It's going to, the women's health conversation is going to loom much larger. They're not going to be able to say, oh, these women are just making selfish choices for themselves. They're going to have to look a bunch of women who are going to have to decide whether it's worth dying over having a baby they don't want to have and tell them that they're making the selfish choice. That's going to be harder. That's going to be worse PR. So I don't think it's, a great move for them. But what do I, they make dumb decisions all the time. So what do I know? You know, what do I know? Speaking of dumb decisions, Trump decided he's going to end the policy of separating children from their parents at the border. But instead, he's going to leave them in detention indefinitely together. So yay, they have their parents, but they're in jail together forever. Like, not a solution to this problem, clearly. We had big demonstrations on the 30th about it. 700 cities had demonstrations. We went to the one in New York. It was very hot, and still a lot of people showed up. And the one in Chicago was also, it was like 100 degrees in Chicago, and that one was massive. You were saying that you saw, like, pictures from area. I'm talking to my dad. The aerial photos of the one in Minneapolis and the one in Chicago, and they all looked really big, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so I feel like that came together really fast, and it's also a topic that people who aren't necessarily really entrenched in electoral politics and the day-to-day of the Trump administration are very concerned about. Like, people are really heartbroken over this issue. It was not just your usual suspects that were bringing it up. It was the only thing that anyone was discussing for weeks. So that's why I say I don't think immigration is going to be a winner for them forever if they can't control themselves. You know, like, it's one thing to fearmonger about immigrants if you aren't going to be, like, crueler than what you're suggesting they're capable of. You know, they like to go on about these people murdered by illegal immigrants or whatever, which is like two people in all of history. As we know from extensive studies, that immigrants commit crimes at much lower rates than Americans do. So, you know, do with that what you will. But I think this mishandling really puts their kind of star issue into a little bit of a difficult spot, because it's hard to scaremonger when you are the thing everyone is scared of. I mean, maybe it's not. I don't know. but so we obviously had a shooting this week as well, because we have one every week. And this was a newsroom shooting, which is a new and exciting form of shooting that we had not been having regularly. But the Capital Gazette in Annapolis had 5 killed in a shooting where they'd been receiving threats for a while, right? They had been getting emails and, I guess, calls as well.
Well, actually, they're getting death threats now.
Oh, they're getting death threats now?
After it, yes.
Oh, there were other newsrooms. That's what it was. Yeah. There were other newsrooms in the area that said that they had been receiving threats.
Yeah, they had
Capital Gazette. But now they're getting more threats.
Yeah, and Trump did not handle this well at all.
No.
He waited like a day or two before he said anything about it, and he was still saying during that period, while people were just trying to understand what had happened, that the press is the enemy. And
yeah,
it's a very disturbing and very bad thing. And from what I read the Capital Gazette did a really an interesting op-ed in their Sunday paper, or editorial in their Sunday paper, about this business of being the victims of this kind of
this
killings.
Rhetoric about the press.
Yeah, and then at the same time having to deal with the fact of the president making comments that were totally inappropriate, or that the death threats and the emails, you know, celebrating the shooting. And it's a very, very disturbing thing.
Well, it's America, where we have a shooting every week. That was the one last week. We have one spot of good news for the week. We started with good news, which was the New York primary results and Ocasio-Cortez's victory. And we're going to end with the Mexican election, which happened yesterday. And their far left, like, Bernie Sanders style candidate won in a landslide, in a kind of unexpected turn of events. I think they were kind of expecting, you know, they've been having a lot of the same struggles with their leadership being sort of Clinton Bush-esque kind of moderate corporatists for a while as well. And that has also not been working that well there. And they have issues with violence and drugs in Mexico, you know, that people in Mexico are as concerned about as Trump would like to pretend he is. And so they really stepped out yesterday. So Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who goes by, does he go by AMLO or does he go, AMLO. It's AMLO, right?
Yeah.
He's kind of, he's a populist and he has some qualities that are vaguely Trumpian in that he loves the drama more so than like a Sanders-esque person. You know, he's a little dramatic. He's a dramatic populist. And his coalition is a little interesting because there are some people on the right in his coalition. He won with a very unusual coalition of voters. But he is, in general, a leftist in the mold of a lot of former Latin American leftist leaders. And what I always say is that I like it when Latin America elects someone on the far left because that means that the U.S. didn't elect it for them. The Latin America has a long history of having their leaders chosen by us. And I think that they, like us, deserve the right to self-determination. And so I always feel happy when a Latin American country elects someone on the far left, not just because it reflects my own politics, but also because it means that we didn't choose the leader for them. And that means that they are getting a right to try something on their own, which they absolutely deserve. So in any case, that's very exciting. Guess the wall thing is going to, going to be tough to get that paid for now. But that's our spot of good news for the end of the week. And that's the news this week. And we'll be back with Brent in 2 weeks because we're on our summer hours. But thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
And we will let you know what happens after what we hope is a quiet July 4th. But you never know with these people. Bye.